Hey, everybody. It's your host, Aisha. It's been a minute. By the way, It's Been a Minute is a really good show if you haven't heard it. I'm glad to be back in your headphones, though it's a little cramped. Anyway, you're about to hear a conversation I recently had with composer John Luther Adams about his piece, Become Desert. It's a follow-up to his Grammy-winning work, Become Ocean, about which we had our first conversation. And I feel like you should know what you're getting into right up front before you listen to the rest of this episode. It's not every day that I have one of the greatest composers of our time whose work is hugely conceptual, rooted in nature, existential. I have him as a captive audience to my questions. So I ask some big stuff. I mean, most of it is related to music, but if you don't like expansive conversations about the essence of what it means to be human, turn back now. I was kidding. Wait. Come back. I promise it's worth it. Desha, you're always undermining yourself. Your therapist said to stop it. Okay, anyway, by the way, new thing. This episode of Classical Classroom is brought to you by Encoda. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the Classical Classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
Oh, I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical music.
I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Desha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I am Desha Clay, and welcoming back for a second time to the classroom, composer John Luther Adams. John spent 40 years living in northern Alaska, and he worked full-time as an environmental activist, but things changed, and he decided instead to become a Pulitzer Prize and Grammy Award-winning composer. So, John, welcome back to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you, Desha. It's lovely to be back.
So last time you were here, I mean, a lot has changed since then. For one, I'm not in Houston anymore. And now I'm in this beautiful part of the world, so I understand your music a whole lot better. And but we were talking last time about Become Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
This was because Taylor Swift, she had donated $50,000 to the Seattle Symphony, who'd recorded that piece because she loved it so much.
Yes.
And that was the first time we chatted. But today we're going to talk about Become Desert, which premiered earlier this year, 2019. So what happened between Ocean and Desert? Why not become, say, mountain or waterfall?
It's actually a trilogy. Desert completes a trilogy that I didn't set out to write, Become Ocean. There's also Become River, which I composed for the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. So it's a smaller orchestra. Mm. So the Become trilogy, if you will, is now recorded in its entirety.
Why didn't you stick with the water theme? And what was it, I guess, in your life that made you go in this direction?
I'm a landlubber. You know, I spent most of my life in interior Alaska, in northern Alaska, a long way from any oceans. It's a bit ironic, but in a certain way, my desert is bigger than my ocean. And that may be just my, you know, my landlubber's perspective. I love tundra and mountains, and I am a desert rat.
Mm-hmm.
So I think part of it is just, you know, my own personal experience and my proclivities. When I was younger, I painted musical landscapes. I made tone poems about particular places that I knew and loved. And I'm still obsessed with place. But in my recent work, and especially in this Become trilogy, in River, Desert, and Ocean, what I'm really trying to do, Desha, is create a place, a musical landscape or waterscape that is its own world, and invite you into that world and allow you to find your own way through it. I'm not giving you a guided tour. I'm not painting you a picture. I'm not telling you a story. Hopefully, I'm creating a place in which you can have your own experience.
I thought about the title of the piece, Become mm-hmm. Desert, and you know how when you see a painting in a gallery, or you see the particular way that a photo is framed, mm-hmm. that those things inform what narrative you're telling yourself in your head about yeah. the work, yeah, in the yeah. same way that the title of a piece of music does.
Yes.
So what was it about the instruments that you used in this piece that you feel like conveyed this particular desert feeling? What instruments did you use?
Yeah, okay, I can talk about that. I'm not sure I can actually answer why I chose these particular instruments.
Mm.
For me, it's all, in a sense, it's all space and it's all color. Both harmony and orchestration are space and color for me. But what I can tell you is that space itself, I'm not just talking about poetic space, metaphorical space, you know, the idea of sublime landscape, all these things that have informed my work for years, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about actual physical, volumetric, three-dimensional or four-dimensional space.
Yeah.
The space that we inhabit, the space within which the music is performed and heard. Space has become perhaps the most fundamental element of my music, so much so that I spent weeks asking myself not only what are the instruments, mm-hmm. what is the orchestra, what is the ensemble for Become Desert, but where are they located?
Ah, interesting.
And it was only when I arrived at, you might say, the map or, you know, the architectural floor plan of the work that I could actually begin writing notes.
Huh.
So there are five groups, five choirs, if you will, in yeah. Become Desert. And the idea is that you, as the listener, are immersed in the music. You are inside the music. The music is not down there on stage in front of you, but mm-hmm. you are inside of it. You are immersed in it. You are swimming in the light. And mm-hmm. the way it's laid out in a concert hall, and the way we've tried to simulate something like that in the recording, is that in front of you, Imagine the big, beautiful concert hall of Benaroya Hall in Seattle, where we mm-hmm. recorded the piece, where we premiered it, where Become Ocean was premiered and recorded. It's one of my favorite halls in the world. So imagine mm-hmm. that big hall, and you're somewhere in the middle of the house. Down in front of you on that big stage is a full array of strings, a full string orchestra.
Yeah.
And scattered among the strings are four, count them, four harpists and four percussionists. And then above and behind the strings and the harps and those percussion is the big woodwind choir. And it's 16 woodwind players. A normal complement of a symphonic complement is three of each flute, oboe, clarinet, bassoon. In Become Desert, we have four of each. So 16 winds and one percussionist playing crotales, which are these beautiful, sometimes called antique cymbals, these beautiful brass-tuned brass yeah. discs that just sound like light to me. Okay, so you got the strings on stage, you got the woodwinds yeah. Up behind them.
Then I can see it.
You're sitting in the house, and off to your left, high, elevated, in a balcony or some gallery off to the side of you, is a choir of eight horns and one percussionist playing chimes. Tubular Bells. Mm-hmm. On the other side, yeah. House right, to your right, is another brass choir. It's trumpets and trombones and another chime player. Okay?
Yeah.
And for the first, I don't know how long, 10, 12, 15 minutes of the piece, you know, the space gradually expands and more of these choirs come into play. And then sometime towards the middle of the piece, you think, well, this is beautiful. This is big. There's sound all around me. And then from behind you, you begin to hear, you're not sure at first, but you think, wait, are those women singing? Are those human voices?
Yeah.
So there's a full choir of human voices behind you, and along with them are handbells. So you've got strings down in front, you've got woodwinds up behind them, you've got brass on either side of you in the hall, you've got singers behind you, and you've got bells everywhere. Big bells, small bells, these points of light. I don't know, are they stars? Are they, you know, sunlight glistening off of something? I have no idea, but you're inside of constant tintabulation. Tintinabulation, right?
What does that mean?
Bell ringing.
Really? Is that an actual word?
Yeah, it is.
Tintinabulation. Wow.
Tintinabulation.
I learned something new today.
Yeah, I think it's kind of onomatopoetic if you think about it. You know, it almost sounds like ting ting ting, you know, like the sound of a bell.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So that's the lay of the land.
And so you had this conception in mind, this like placement.
Yep.
Like how you wanted the music to surround people and immerse people in the environment before you picked out what specific instruments were going to be in the places.
Yeah, at the same time, you know, it's hard to say which came first. You know, it's a chicken or egg kind of thing. But it's certainly before I started writing many notes. I maybe had some vague ideas about the harmonies of the piece and the shape of the piece, you know, how time might float. But always the first question I've asked myself in composing throughout my creative life, you know, it's, well, what are the instruments? But in this piece, there was a second question inseparable from the first, and that is, where are they located? So you can imagine that each one of these choirs that I just described to you, these five different groups of musicians, is its own color, its own timbre, you know, its own tone color, but also each has its own register, its own relative brightness, and its own harmonic coloration, too.
Yeah.
And then you get to be in the middle of it as the colors wash over you and mix, like a sunrise or a sunset.
When the thing you said about the voices, that when you're listening to the piece, just even on headphones, you literally do ask yourself, am I hearing voices?
Yes.
Or is that another instrument? Like you almost can't pick it apart.
I love
from
that.
The music.
I love that. I love not knowing, and there's so much sound in this piece, as there is in Become Ocean, I think especially in Become Desert, you can't listen to it all at once. You just, it overloads your senses. And these bells all around you, first the high bells and then lower bells, and, you know, they're these constant points of these calls to attention. Here, there, oh, behind me. Trying to keep you awake, you know, almost like they use bells in, I imagine, you know, the Tibetan Buddhists use bells.
Yeah.
Although I didn't think about that until afterwards. In fact, it was a listener who said, yeah, you know, desert, but sort of reminded me of the Himalaya, you know. Great. But there's a way in which I'm consciously trying to saturate the space and saturate our ears so that there's this wonderful sense of disorientation and mm-hmm. you're not sure what you're hearing or where it's coming from. There's an inscription in the score from a beautiful poem by one of my favorite poets, the great Mexican poet Octavio Paz. He has this lovely mm-hmm. poem called Piedra Nativa, Native Stone. And there's just this one line in that poem that leaped out at me. English translation, roughly, he says, close your eyes and listen to the singing of the light.
Oh, that's so good.
Isn't that beautiful? And that was sort of my motto. It's actually the inscription on the front page of the score. And mm-hmm. so I hope the experience of hearing this piece in a live performance and in a recording as well allows the listener the opportunity to just luxuriate in space and light and color and to be fully present, to be listening deeply here and now, wherever you may be.
Wait, like taking it back to the description of like physical space.
Yep.
When you're actually in space, it's hard to pick the space that you're in apart. Or when you're experiencing anything, really, it's hard to pick it apart as it's happening. You can only sort of in hindsight.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do it. Which yep. is how this music sounds.
And that's yeah. the idea. You know, not taking a picture of it, not making the selfie of yourself standing by the pyramids or Machu Picchu or whatever.
Right.
But just turning your phone off and being there and allowing yourself to slow down and maybe feel lost, maybe feel like, oh well, nothing's happening or how long is this going to go on? Is anything going to change? I'm bored. Oh, that's really, what is that? Where's that? You know, if it's an invitation to a different mode of awareness.
Yeah.
Just an invitation to be fully present in the moment, in the place.
This episode of Classical Classroom is sponsored by Maestro Classics. They're the creators of Stories and Music, which is this recorded series that they made for kids and families. It's won more than 50 awards, not to mention general adoration from the people who listen to it. It features the London Philharmonic Orchestra, and it takes those musical stories and it brings them to life. It's one of those things where kids learn while they're having fun, without actually knowing that they're learning. And there's an activity book that goes along with it. It's a whole thing. Maestro Classics just announced a brand new recording in this series called Bach and the Organ. It's all about J.S. Bach, who you may have heard of on this very show, and it tells the story of his life while talking about the pipe organ, which, P.S., back in the day, was the most advanced mechanical instrument that had ever existed. And you can learn more about this album and the rest of the series at maestroclassics.com, and wait for it. You can also save 17% off of your order by using coupon code CLASSROOM. Yay! Hey, musician types. Are you still flipping sheet music pages? Well, while I respect your retro hipster lifestyle choice, I've got something that might just change your mind. It's called Encoda. N-K-O-D-A. And it's a subscription service, a la Spotify or Netflix, for digital sheet music. And just like those services, it gives you access to more content than you could possibly shake a stick at. I don't know why you would want to shake a stick at it, but you couldn't, because there are literally thousands of easy-to-find pieces of music in their library. You can check that out at encoda.com, by the way. With these digital scores, you can mark them up, just like your beloved paper, but you can also do cool digital things like create your own sheet music playlists and share stuff online. Are you intrigued? Well, download the Encoda app today from your app store for a free trial. That's Encoda, N-K-O-D-A, Encoda. And now back to my conversation with John Luther Adams about his piece, Become Desert. I'm going to ask you this question that I hardly ever ask anybody because I don't even always like to know this about music. But considering how you've put this music together, what's your creative process? Are you just, is your creative process literally just being in nature and listening to it? or is there, are you watching slow-mo videos of desert while you're composing?
No, like, I'm not doing
that. Or do
you
have a process?
I'm not doing that. You know, since I left Alaska, I've been living in the Sonoran Desert of Mexico. I've been living in the Atacama Desert of Chile. I'm now living in the Chihuahuan Desert. And the music comes directly out of my own experience being in place. You know, I went north in 1975.
Yeah.
It was a different world then. What was I? 22. But I went north as an inspiring composer, a young artist, with this dream that I might be able to step, if not completely outside, at least to the margins of my own culture. And go back to the original source of all human cultures.
Wow.
And really all human, everything that we are, the very shape of the shape and substance of our bodies and our minds, it all derives from the world.
No big whoop, just to the core of what it is to be human, that's all.
That was the idea. And of course, it's a patently absurd proposition that that we can work outside of ourselves, but that's the aspiration, and it's not that far removed without putting too fine a point on it or sounding too precious, I hope, but it's not that far removed from the impulses that lie at the foundation of religious practice, you know?
Yeah.
People have asked me, especially about Become Ocean, but also Become Desert, you know, well, which ocean? Which desert? And yeah, I have my ocean and I have my deserts. But my answer to that question is your ocean, your desert.
Mm. You're sort of setting us down inside of it and saying, okay, fend for yourself.
It's an invitation, but it's also a responsibility. I mean, you have to work. You actually have to pay attention. You have to listen. Sometimes people will say, oh yeah, I love your piece Becoming Ocean. And, you know, they get the title wrong. But that speaks to, I think, a misconception. If I were telling you a story about becoming something becoming, then that would be a perfectly suitable title. But in fact, the title is Become Ocean, which is an invitation and, in a sense, a gentle command. Right?
It's like a directive.
It's on you. You know, Become Ocean, we're riding the waves. We're in a small boat in an enormous sea, or maybe you're swimming, or you know, another person is on their surfboard. But you know, we're on the ocean, and at times it feels as though we're going to be overwhelmed by the waves. That we are going to truly become ocean. But in a sense, we're on the ocean. And we're swimming on the surface. In Become Desert, we're actually immersed. And once again, we're swimming, but we're swimming in light and space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, that's interesting that you say that, because I remember listening to Become Ocean and loving it, but like feeling like there was something really ominous about it.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know, I'm kind of terrified of the oceans.
Me too.
Like, I mean, they're just so vast and you don't know what's down there.
Yeah.
I have this whole thing about like deep water like that. And it's like, what, two-thirds of the planet? So it seems weird to be afraid of it. But yeah, like I heard that in the music. And in Become Desert, it sounds so much more like there's a levity almost to it. It sounds lighter, like the instruments that you're using in the piece sound lighter.
Yeah, Become Ocean is a very deep, dark piece. Become Desert is expansive. As I'm suggesting, you know, in a way it's bigger even than Become Ocean, but it's much more open. It's much brighter in the orchestration and in the harmonic colors.
So it strikes me like there's kind of a little bit of a paradox you've got going on here, right? Because you're trying to capture, like in your music, you're capturing a present moment. And the way that this music like moves along, the changes are infinitesimal. You know, like you barely, like you look up and things have changed, but you don't really sense them changing as you're listening.
Yep.
They just sort of do.
That's sort of like being in a landscape when the light is changing, right? You don't really notice it, but then you notice it.
I feel like you're capturing a snapshot or something with these pieces, and they're not changing, but they are changing. You're saying be present, but also change. That's the paradox to me.
Yeah, I mean,
observe the change.
Depending on how you listen, whether you're willing to suspend your disbelief and slow down, or not. You know, you might think, well, the more it changes, the more it stays the same. But really, I would say the longer we stay in one place, the more we notice change. You know, we spend our lives now on screens perpetually.
Yes.
You know, we're no place. The internet is no place. And even when we travel, we run around to destinations.
Mm-hmm.
To places that are supposed to be fabulous, and we take pictures of ourselves. We make selfies of ourselves in these places, but are we really there?
Can I just ask you a really self-indulgent question? So this is, you know, I came from Houston, which is, you know, it's not, I love that town, but it's not known for its natural beauty.
Yeah.
So I come up here I come up here to the Pacific Northwest. This morning, I took a water taxi into work.
Oh, nice.
And on one side, I've got Mount Rainier. On the other side, I've got Olympic Mountains. I go hiking now. I'm around all these trees and stuff. But this is the first time that I've ever experienced this. And I often find myself having these moments where I'll be out amongst these like old growth monster trees, moss and all this stuff. And I find that I don't know what to do.
Good.
So I just keep walking.
It's a little scary, isn't it?
What do we do, John? Like, what do we do with the natural world? I mean, you've figured out something to do. You've written music about it. But like, what do we as people do with it when we're used to always being so goal-oriented?
There are very few of us anymore who actually know or are at home anywhere.
Yeah.
Most of us, we're constantly running around. We live in kind of equally homogenous urban-suburban environments, or we insulate ourselves from where we actually are. And for me, it's close to the heart of the matter of not only what we're missing in our lives, but what's fundamentally out of harmony in our relationship with this miraculous world that is the only home we will ever know. And we better figure this out, or the world's going to be fine. You know, we're always talking about, oh, we're going to save the Earth. The Earth is going to be fine. It's ourselves that we need to save, and we better get busy. And you know, the first the first step for me is learning to be at home wherever we may be. And because if we don't know where we are in a very real and how we fit in to the larger dance of life, then in a very real sense, we have no idea who we ourselves are.
That's true.
We're at a dangerous moment, perhaps an unprecedented moment in the history of our species, and certainly in recent years, and whatever we call this society we're in now, this post-industrial cyber society,
digital hellscape.
So yeah. for me, I think music is a lifelong search. It's a lifelong journey in search of home. So if you're walking in that old growth forest and you don't know what to do, and it's because you don't really know where you are yet or how you fit in, and it's a little scary, and it's dark, and the trees are big, and embrace it. You got to go into it.
The groundlessness of that feeling of just like, all right, what do I do with it? I feel like your music is the sound of that.
Well, thank you.
It's the sound of what I hear when I'm like just plunged into some natural environment.
Thank you. It's not because I'm trying to tell you a story, although I certainly hope that the music is meaningful to you as a listener, that it touches something in you that maybe you had forgotten. But it's almost physician heal thyself, you know. First and foremost, I'm the first listener, and I'm trying. This is what I need for myself.
Yeah.
And then if I can give it to my fellow humans, my fellow travelers, and maybe it's useful to some of them, what a miracle that is, and it keeps me going.
It's true, you know. And that reminds me of something that you said that I read. What you said, that you think, or at least this is a paraphrase, obviously, that the music could do more to change the world than politics. What does that mean? Why? How?
It's always been that way. If you look at human culture, except for the occasional unforgettable horrors of human history, the best of what we remember historical societies and cultures for is creative thought. It's music, it's literature, it's creative thought, and the answers that we need, even the questions themselves, are not going to come from politicians. I don't care who they are, how well-intentioned they may be. It's getting harder and harder to find those people these days.
Right.
But the so-called leaders do not lead. They follow the people, and they eventually, as they try to keep them down, eventually change comes from the ground up. And it comes especially from creative thought, which is, I would say, the essence of what it is to be a human animal. And it's certainly the essence of what art is about, and the best of science as well.
So do you think it's working? Do you think that music then is changing things in the way that you wanted for it to? Because you personally, you started out as... You did lots of environmental activism, hands-on stuff. Do you think that the music is having that impact?
Look, we're all doing the best we can to do the best we can. Each of us, for each of us, it's a different contribution, right?
Yeah.
But things are this is a dark moment in our history. And I'm not talking just about Los Estados Unidos. I'm talking about the world. I'm talking about the human species. So all caring people are asking ourselves, what best can I do? And I was deeply involved as an environmental activist in Alaska in my 20s and in my 30s. And the time came when I realized that quite frankly, I just didn't have the personality, the temperament, or really the courage for a life in that world. And, you know, I bailed out and I rededicated myself to art, to music as the center of my life. And and I believe that it's the best thing that I can do. And
yeah,
that's all that any of us can do. This is my best gift to a troubled world. I look for hope now in different places. I find hope and reassurance a little bit in that feeling of uncertainty that you feel walking through that dark forest. It's like, I am small. The world is large and time is deep. And that to me is somehow both terrifying and profoundly reassuring. And I continue my work, and I will as long as I can, in the faith that maybe something I am doing will mean something to someone I will never know, who may help to bring about a better world, as we call it, and a culture that is more deeply in harmony with the earth. And That's a culture that I will never live to inhabit, but that's the culture I'm working for.
Art saves lives.
Yeah.
I think it does. Well, John, thank you so much for coming back to the Classical Classroom.
My pleasure, Daisha.
This has been great. And unfortunately, we have to go back to the world outside of these studios now. All right, well, John, take care and come back next time. You said this was a trilogy.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Do you think it ends there?
Yes, and I can tell you with certainty that it ends there, because the boss, Cynthia, my best friend, my wife of 40 years, has said, "John, no more Becoming." That's it. Get
and
a new title, pal.
Cynthia wins. Awesome. Well, John, thanks again. I really appreciate you.
My pleasure, Daisha. Let's do it again.
All right, everybody. That does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. We hope that you enjoyed it, had epiphanies, know yourself better as a person. For more of this kind of thing, go to classicalclassroomshow.com, listen to all of our episodes, connect with our social media, send us a message, even make us a financial gift. And another way to support us, by the way, is to subscribe to, rate, and review the show wherever you listen. That way is totally free. Thanks to the home of Classical Classroom, King FM, where we're about to move into a new building. So we packed all the dishes and we're eating nothing but takeout from here on out. Thanks to the birthplace of Classical Classroom, Houston Public Media. Thanks to the official moving company of Classroom, Musical Movers, where we move your stuff, but mostly we sing about the process. Super useful. Thanks to John Luther Adams for being on the show. Thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.